and welcome to Buddies Without Organs. Forgot the name of the podcast for a second there. I'm Sean. I'm here with Matt.
Hi, Sean.
And Corey.
Hey, buddies.
How is everybody doing this horrible, cold, dark, blustery December day?
Well, the funny thing is that it's pretty dark and blustery here in Melbourne, even though it's meant to be summer. La Nina,
really?
I think, is just like, just kicking our summer's ass. It's, you know, we had one day over 30 degrees the other day, and that's been it for like weeks.
Well, that's the lingering British cultural influence. Like, we didn't have... We had, like, a day of summer this year ourselves before plunging back into winter. So there you go. That, you know, sort of like these, like, cosmic resonances. They keep on vibrating down through history. That's what's going on there.
Yeah.
The lingering cultural influence of our carbon footprint, probably.
So this is the collision between, you know, me being sort of like rooted in like post-Heideggerian idealism or whatever comes smashing up against Matt's sort of like rigorous materialism.
Oh, climate crisis is real.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
It's with a capital R. Sorry.
Oh, God. Oh, we're doing well, aren't we? So this is so let's start off with the announcement that I think our listeners will know already, that this is going to be our last episode of the year. We know we've had quite a bit of a gap between this episode and the last one, but this is the last episode we're doing of the year, and this is also the last episode of our present format, because very excitingly we are going to be doing stuff on the Zero Books channel next year. We are going to be doing a series of indeterminate, indefinite length at the time, at a time of recording, where we're going to be exploring in the same way, but hopefully in the same way, the same level of like depth and rigor that we've been trying to do with Deleuze and Guattari. We're going to be doing the same with the works of Mark Fisher. It's going to be releasing it under the name Bodies Without Organs Presents The K Files. And although the specifics, the details are still sort of like being determined, but, you know, hopefully we should be kicking that off relatively quickly in the new year. Hopefully we'll be getting them out a lot quicker than we've been able to with this, because as anyone who's read Fisher will know, and I'm certain that many of our listeners will have done so, he wrote quite, you know, very sort of like good, sort of like quite punky, accessible stuff. I mean obviously a lot of it's blog posts, for goodness sake, so you know kind of like almost by definition they're meant to be stuff that you can sort of like read and digest like fairly quickly. So hopefully we'll be able to produce a lot more going to use the dreaded C word, content, than we have been previously. But yes, and we're also hoping that we are going to be able to go into a kind genuinely into kind of like a comparable depth talking about the influences that Mark Fisher is bringing to the table with his writings. So there will still be, you know, it was largely be the same kind of thing, us talking extensively about theory. There'll be a lot of Deleuze in there, obviously, but hopefully will also give us an opportunity to talk more widely about other theorists from sort of like related to Deleuze as well. I imagine that we'll be talking a lot more about stuff like psychoanalysis and critical theory than we have done beforehand, and we'll also be talking about like the media that Fisher is engaging with. As people might have guessed from following me on Twitter, our very first episode we're going to be talking about Children of the Stones, which we're not going to get into that right now, because there's just so much fun stuff to talk about with that. but for now we are going to be talking a bit about The Fold, but we have decided that it defeated us. That was part of the reason why we had such a long delay, was that it was just really, really difficult to kind of like deal with that book while also dealing with real world things. And actually I met up with some friends who I made during my master's degree a few weeks ago, and I was talking to you, so like one of the, well, he's a PhD now, he's got his doctorate now, about the podcast. And I mentioned, oh, you know, we've been struggling a little bit doing The Fold. And he said, well, I actually know hardcore like Deleuze scholars who do not know what Deleuze was doing with that book. So when he said that, I thought, okay, maybe we should just cut, maybe we could do a FUT something that isn't The Fold, because it's really difficult. So, although the topic of this episode is going to be the event, and we're going to be talking about several different texts over the next however long we're recording, which is going to include stuff from The Fold. So if people are really looking forward to that, we are still going to be talking about it, but we are also going to be talking about stuff from Immanence of Life and Logic of Sense as well. So yeah. Right, where should we start? Should we just dive in? How do we all feel about that?
I guess thanks for that intro. That was kind of a great, I feel like there's so much, I feel like, that's happened, and we could have rambled on about it for ages, and you just nipped it in the bud straight away. but, and I feel like there's still quite a lot here. I've kind of really actually been really excited to do this episode, not only because it's kind of what kept me somewhat excited about The Fold, but I feel like the event is maybe, I think, one of the most interesting and most important concepts in Deleuze's whole body of work, really. It kind of comes up everywhere, so there it is. Quite where to start is kind of a pretty operative question. We've chosen these three texts. We could have probably chosen three different ones and come up with a completely different podcast, but maybe it's worth us just having like a, I don't know, initial impressions, what everybody, maybe we could each try and have a go at defining what an event or the event even is.
Do you want to go first doing that, Matt?
Sure, but I guess I think what I'm interested to see is, I sort of went through all the text over the last week, and I've pulled out about 6 pages worth of quotes, and I think they all help define the event in its own way, and I'm not entirely sure how to approach it without just going through all 3 texts. And I guess the one thing that maybe there's that we can start with, maybe we'll just start with The Fold, because there's a very short chapter in that book that Deleuze titles What is an Event? What is the Event? And considering how dense that book is, it is really swift. It's like, a couple of pages, I think. But I feel like it connects into a lot of what we've already talked about in kind of an interesting way. So maybe there's a chance to pull a bunch of threads together. But the one definition that I think is really clear in that chapter, maybe this can be a jumping off point, is that Deleuze says the event is the passage of nature. Discuss.
I'll be honest, I didn't read the bit from The Fold, I'll be honest. I did read the stuff from Logic of Sense and Immanence of Life. But so I'm gonna have to rely on you a little bit for the stuff about The Fold. But I'll give a very, very brief sort of like few initial thoughts, and then I want to hand over to the two of you, because I've spoken a lot already. But sort of what I've been reminded of looking at this and reading this is some of those, I think we've all had experience, you know, the kind of questions that you ask when you're a kid, right? Those kind of foundational questions of knowledge that you kind of never really exactly get answers to, and they become the questions that, yeah, the questions that you don't get answers to, but eventually you just kind of stop asking. And I think one of those is maybe not even the question exactly, but when you become aware, when you become really aware of the passage of time, and I think we become aware of it through observing something in motion, like the flow of water or a flame, or even, you know, like one of those videos, or sort of like a fast forward video of a flower blossoming or something. You have this sense that you can have this kind of primitive sense almost of, you can never quite determine when the moment is occurring. When you try to sort of have this is the moment, you're aware that you don't, that that has passed by and through, and that what you were doing, you were anticipating a moment, and then you were retaining a moment, but the moment itself never actually arrives. And instead, what you become aware of is that what you deal with and experience is actually a flow, a movement, a happening. So I find often what philosophy can do at its most rewarding is it kind of just brings back to mind those primordial questions, of those kind of primordial experiences of consciousness and the mind almost. And again, sort of, it has this effect of estranging us from our ordinary experiences as well. In the same way that, as a child, when you're learning things for the first time, you have a sense of their strangeness, which you then forget. And what I think in one of the part of the value of engaging with philosophy is it can remind us of these things. It can reintroduce the strangeness that's actually always inhabiting the world to us. I'm not going to say more about that right now, because I really want the two of you to have some space.
No, I definitely picked up on some of the same stuff as you, Sean, to do with the moment and the, the ungraspable nature of the moment. And so, like, I think one of the things that came up with the event is that, no event is, discrete. That, everything, they extend forward and backwards in time. So, there is no moment, because every event, every moment is connected to everything that preceded and comes from it. And so it was really interesting to consider, chains of events. There is no event, there is only chains of events. And the way that the chains interlink and impact each other. That was one of the strands I picked up on there.
Yeah, I think what's really interesting about this as a concept is that, I think you're both absolutely right. And I guess it's that what's so strange about it is there's this tension where I think for Deleuze, what in approaching the event is kind of it's actually a moral question for him, but he kind of puts that in the biggest framework possible. So we can kind of, and I think it kind of relates back. It's kind of nice actually again, that we're actually doing this for the sort of our last Deleuzean episodes. We started off with a body without organs, right? I guess because it's our sort of namesake. Because I think we did.
We did. No,
it's like a long time ago now.
I think our first episode was The Plane of Imminence. Or was it?
It was.
No, that was the second, because I listened to that one to bone up for this one. So I think the first was
We must bodies. Have started with a body. Oh, it doesn't matter.
We did. I've just checked our own website. We did. You can't remember. It was a year ago. But, I feel like the event's kind of like a... It's almost like it's like a levelling up of that as a concept. Like, it's the... when Deleuze... And this at least is in The Fold. I guess this is... I'm actually kind of glad that we branched it out, because I don't necessarily feel like the way it's used in The Fold is that interesting. It kind of feels like a bit of a... Everything that's there is far much more rigorously and kind of interestingly explored elsewhere. But I think that point where he says that the event is the passage of nature, it's kind of, as you said, Sean, that, yeah, you get that... it's as if the... If we're going to talk, as we talked about with the body without organs, maybe one way of putting it is it's the body without organization. It's the body without that signifying framework that we kind of lay over it to produce meaning and understanding. And I feel like the event is kind of a similar concept, but it's sort of time, maybe without a calendar. If it's the passage of nature, what is nature not restricted by? Our understanding of the seasons or like an agricultural framework or whatever else, that we also give meaning to it. So just as sort of Deleuze says, we don't know what a body can do when he's talking about Spinoza. I think there's a sense that when it comes to events, to time, though we historicize and try and organize everything, often with the benefit of hindsight, we actually still don't know how things happen. We don't know And I guess it's also interesting because it ties into a lot of what we're probably going to go and talk about when we talk about Mark Fisher. We don't know what constitutes the new. We don't know necessarily what is just a repetition of what has come before. And I feel like the event for Deleuze is kind of this stretching over, this concept that stretches over all of that. So with the example that you used, Sean, of like, I always think of that, isn't it like a YouTube series where they have a scientist try and explain an idea or a concept to like five different levels of expertise, like a five-year-old to like a postdoctorate student or something like that. And they kind of go up in levels of complexity. It's still the same concept, no matter who they're kind of, what level they're explaining it at, but maybe you, in doing that, you can kind of see how knowledge develops. Like, you're talking about the same thing, which doesn't necessarily change in itself, but how that is kind of stretched over, how that resonates through life, a life, which I guess we can come on to. It can't be defined by each moment, how it's divided up. I think in difference and repetition, Deleuze uses the example of like historical events. I think he uses the example of the French Revolution, but I think a better example is always like 9/11. 9/11 was a day, but then it also, within being what, like 20 years since it happened, we still refer to it as kind of like a measure of, it measures our distance from a moment. And we can now go back and look at that and we can think, well, how did that, what led to that event to allow it to happen? What was the kind of how do we understand 9/11 from the perspective of the 90s or the 80s, the kind of, you know, the rise of Osama bin Laden or whatever else? How do we understand 9/11 considering everything that's happened since in terms of the way that airport security has changed? In all of that, 9/11, the event of 9/11 is in that understanding. And that's how the event kind of reverberates to the past and the future. And it sounds like kind of almost a mundane concept in that regard, but when you consider how we actually don't, how it's not remotely intuitive to how we think about how things happen, it becomes really interesting, I think.
Yeah. And again, it's like, it is one of those sort of like naive childhood sort of like moments of reflection again, sort of like when you try to sort of like determine when does something start. You know, what's the actual beginning of something? And you discover, and you know, this is one of those problems that has been with philosophy since before there was philosophy. You know, this is Zeno's arrow, you know, the discovery that there's always a moment before the moment. And no matter how far back you go, you do not meet the moment of moments. Obviously that's one of the bits of reasoning that's classically deployed to argue for the existence of God, as sort of like, well, the foundational moment that stands outside of the chain of moments is the only way that we can have the chain of moments, to have this meta dimension to it. I think maybe because I'd like us to move on to sort of like talking about the texts themselves a little bit, because I've got notes prepared specifically about A Life, Immanence of Life, because I just absolutely fell in love reading reading that. But I think maybe if we start off talking about Logic of Sense, I have my copy of it here, and I have the I'm just gonna sort of like grind an axe face slightly in that I really have a special loathing for the Bloomsbury Revelation editions of all of these books, because they're just like really, really nastily cheaply sort of like put together, and you know, sort of like they'll have like random breaks and sort of like the middle of words, because they've just copied it from like previous editions without actually formatting it correctly, and you get type. So I have use my hard-earned money to buy second-hand copies of the old Continuum editions of all of these books, and because they're just they're proper. And this one's actually like I think this is University of Greenwich. Yeah, I've got withdrawn from the University of Greenwich Library, so it's got like library laminations on the cover and like one of those old like magnetic strips, so you can't read the blurb. This isn't interesting to the listener.
Did you get some free highlighting from previous students?
No, it is clean, but it does have stamped on the side University of Greenwich. But yeah, no, I'm very happy to have this. This isn't interesting to anybody, but I just kind of like just thought I'd share that, because I do just have such a like. Oh God, I hate the Bloomsbury.
I feel like we're all book nerds here, so it's all good.
no one cool listens to this. Actually, no, I take that back. If you're listening to this, you're the coolest cat around. I'm drinking Jim Beam as we record this, so I'm cool as well. Yeah, I just wanted to read a little bit from this to... no, that's the preface. I don't want the preface. I want chapter one. I want the first series of Paradoxes of Pure Becoming. We'll say actually a little bit about The Logic of Sense. It's a very, which isn't a book I've finished, but it's a very, very chewy book. It reminds me a lot more of The Fold than it does A Thousand Plateaus or Anti-Oedipus. You know, so it is quite academic, but it also is a lot more readable than The Fold is at places as well. So here, okay, I'm just going to read a paragraph. Sorry, everybody, I'm just going to read a paragraph because this is the... yeah, I'll go with the first paragraph, actually. Alice and Through the Looking Glass involve a category of very special things. Events. Pure events. When I say Alice becomes larger, I mean that she becomes larger than she was. By the same token, however, she becomes smaller than she is now. Certainly, she is not bigger and smaller at the same time. She is larger now. She was smaller before. But is at the same moment that one becomes larger than one was and smaller than one becomes. This is the simultaneity of a becoming whose characteristic is to elude the present. Insofar as it eludes the present, becoming does not tolerate the separation or the distinction of before and after, or of past and future. It pertains to the essence of becoming to move and to pull in both directions at once. Alice does not grow without shrinking, and vice versa. Good sense affirms that in all things there is a determinable sense or direction, sens, but paradox is the affirmation of both senses or directions at the same time. And I mean, what the logic of sense is fundamentally is a series of meditations on paradoxes. And it kicks off with I remember when I first read this, just finding it quite baffling. When I first read this, and it was only like it was last year that I picked this up and sort of like started to read it, and it was only on like a second attempt through it I kind of like reconsidered that and kind of got what he was talking about there a bit, because it is, and this is what I mean about this, it's kind of like a return to a pre-philosophical naivety of just being really weirded out by how things happen. And you know, like I do sometimes like align myself with the view that philosophy tells us nothing that we didn't already know. It just reminds us of it. And I think this is a really good example of that, because what Deleuze is saying there is when we consider events, when we consider becomings, and all events are a becoming, again, you get, if you try to talk about it in terms of past, present, future, or talk about it in terms of presence, rather, you do not find it. You can't do it like that. It always eludes the present. All you can do is speak about it in this very kind of elliptical way about sort of like transitional becomings from past into future, but without ever actually arriving at a present, because Alice is always larger than she was and is smaller than she is now. It's when we try to consider the moment of when we try to consider becoming. And there's this sense almost that when we consider happenings, events, becomings, it's like they're obeying a whole different set of like physical laws almost to how ordinary things behave. When we talk about things in certain metric, you know, definite terms, when we try to actually consider the happening and the becoming and the eventing, we get lost when we try to think about it like that. And yet all the same, we know that it is real and is happening. There's no doubt about its truth and its reality, but it's such a paradoxical truth that it is almost like encountering the mystical. And this is why, you know, these are the foundational questions of Greek philosophy. This is the stuff that like the pre-Socratics tried to wrestle with, you know, this awareness that you can't ever arrive at the present moment, for instance, and this sense that sort of like there is, I don't want to say transcendental because that's something of a loaded word, but this sense of just that there's just a strangeness to existence. Corey, do you have I'd be very interested to hear sort of your thoughts on this, because Matt and I have been dominating the conversation a bit.
Yeah, well, this section really grabbed me, even though it is only like three pages or something in the text.
It's so short.
It's so tiny. But yeah, because it kind of ties into something that I wrote in my novel Repo Virtual. So yeah, like I'm going to have to re-quote this because I think this is part of what you said. Becoming does not tolerate the separation or the distinction of before and after or of past and future. It pertains to the essence of becoming to move and to pull in both directions at once. And so, yeah, like this is, as we've been saying, this is like, you know, Deleuze saying that there is no single moment of becoming, that every becoming is an event, you know, like just as Matt was saying about 9/11 being an event that goes backwards and forwards in time, like every moment is, or every becoming is the same. So I was thinking that like a person's life is an event. And when you say someone died, that becoming started before they were even born. And so life is an ongoing process of becoming right up until it ends. And then one of the main threads of my novel Repo Virtual, it follows the awakening of the world, of that world's first true AI. And there's a chapter where I kind of did my best to try and imagine what that would look like the process of this being becoming sentient and self-aware, you know, quite rapidly, whilst trapped inside a digital world. And in that section I wrote, there is terror in becoming. And I hadn't read any Deleuze when I wrote that, but like this chapter kind of resonates with what I was, like where my head was at that time. Because like becoming is not something that you do and then it's done. It's ongoing. And like that on its own is frightening. Like people tend to be afraid of change to at least some degree. But we're never not changing as people. We never stop becoming. So we have to reconcile the terror and uncertainty of becoming with the knowledge that it's unavoidable.
I think that's the really weird thing that happens here. Because I think when we talk about becoming, especially in the context of like Deleuze and Guattari, I think they often have this sense of they talk about becoming quite affirmatively, as if it's something that you do, or like they talk about like a kind of there's a becoming woman, becoming animal. They have all these different versions, I guess, in A Thousand Plateaus. But I feel like, yeah, in here it kind of becomes more clear that it, becoming isn't something that you do. So becoming is something that happens to you, and how you respond to that is kind of, well, I think for Deleuze, at least if Deleuze has an ethics, that's the crux of his ethics. And I guess it's, yeah, that's totally in the this sort of pre-Socratic sense, or even, well, it's the, I've kind of been really in a bit of a nerdy hole with this recently, reading up about Deleuze's interest in Stoicism, which is all over this book. But he kind of has that same, there's a bit where he sort of talks about like a Stoic version of time, which is kind of what we've already said. There's like he has the Aeon and Chronos, and Chronos is the kind of phenomenological time, an all-encompassing present that fills up everything, that is your sense of now that you can't escape. But Aeon is like a separate from that. It's like a different plane, like past and future are together and exist elsewhere. And I feel like that's kind of like it makes it sound really weird, but I feel like we're kind of more used to that concept than we would think, because it is kind of in lots of horror films or whatever else, like the this other plane where the past haunts us, or even our futures haunt, even like something like, well, this is our Christmas episode, it's like, well, what about Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol, right? Like that's, I feel like that's kind of, maybe that's probably, I hadn't actually thought of it before starting this episode, but I feel like that's a great way of, you know, you've got Scrooge, right? Scrooge is in an all-encompassing present that he can't escape, but he is visited by both, what is it? Is it the past of Ghost of Christmas? Is there a Ghost of Christmas Present too, isn't it?
Yes, yes. Yeah. That's
the, but it's kind of separate from him though still, right? It's like a kind of, there is, like, because Deleuze says elsewhere that there is a present of the past future. There's like there is a present of Aeon. That's different from the present of Chronos, that's probably not worth getting into. But it's interesting that, you know, you have like Scrooge, that film is told from Scrooge's, almost from his first person point of view, but he then travels through these other times that are kind of elsewhere, that he has to be sort of taken onto a ghostly plane to explore. And how he responds to that, right? You get a sense of this other realm, you get the sense of other things that are happening far beyond your control, or maybe things that are so you have some sort of causal role in the outcome of something. You sense your place in the midst of things, which is a phrase that Deleuze uses all the time. So it's how you kind of respond to a knowledge of that other plane. That's kind of where this ethical question comes in, almost, or a moral question. And yeah, I guess I think it is. It's that there's a horror there for sure. That terror of becoming, I think, is totally it's scary. But I guess that's the sort of central question for this book, I think, less explicitly, but especially also, I mean, not to jump to it too early, but also in The Pure Imminence of Life, this sort of similar. I think he also talks about Charles Dickens in there too. But
I do want to point out, I just checked, and it is possible that Deleuze saw Muppet's Christmas Carol. he died in 95, and that came out in 92. There's crossover there, so...
Oh, shit! Wow.
Didn't want to get too highbrow there. I remember being very pleased with myself when I found that it was technically possible that Heidegger listened to Autobahn by Kraftwerk. One thing I kind of wanted to... This is maybe ever so slightly tangential, but... it reminded what you were saying, though, because the contrast between Kronos and Eon. Was it Eon or Ion?
To be fair, I don't know. I've just run with Ion, but it might even be Eon.
Well, I was just going to say, it just reminds me that there is in New Testament theology, there's a distinction between Kronos, which is used to refer to a specific passage to like ordinary time, basically, but then there's also alongside it Kairos, which because back in that, I think I mentioned it, might have mentioned this before, but back in 2019 I went to see, I attended a theology conference about called New Trinitarian Ontologies at Cambridge. That was my summer holiday that year, because I'm cool, and one of the speakers, Graham Hancock, I think his name was, said that he talked about that, and he said that talk about the distinction with the idea of the coming in of these two different, or the contrast between these two different kinds of time, or Chronos, is just the ordinary, is the time of the ordinary world of the mundane world. Well, Kairos is not only is God's time, it's also kind of like mythic time. It's the, so when in the Gospel of Mark, when it says that the time is fulfilled because the kingdom is at hand, that the word that's used there is Kairos, this idea of a kind of sort of like this is, and I think something similar is being talked about here a little bit, the idea that sort of like there is the ordinary happening, and then there is the happening, then there's the event that comes in, that, and this actually, my first encounter with the philosophy of the event was actually a slim little book that Zizek wrote called The Event, that I read, I think it was my last year of university, back in 2014. And he was talking, I don't believe he was talking about Deleuze in that, I don't remember if he mentions him or not. And that was before I knew who Deleuze was. But he talks about Bourdieu a lot in that. And the sense that they use the term event, I don't think is necessarily contradicting how Deleuze talks about it, but for them, the event is a happening which alters the rules of the game so fundamentally that it's as if they have always been the new way that they are now. And I think Zizek has previously given the revolutions of 1848 as an example of an event of that kind, which obviously those are like the great failed revolutions in European history. But at the same time, they just so clearly demonstrated that things are different now, that there was no way for the monarchies of Europe to try and incorporate them into their history. They just had to be things that actually never happened, because you can't deal with them. You have to just insist that sort of no, this crashing in of Kairos did not happen. The old way of things is the only way that things have ever been, and we can't have this arrival of this new event that just fundamentally alters everything. And, you know, the great example of that is the French Revolution, you know, obviously. So, like, even more so than the American Revolution, which obviously was radical in its own way, the French Revolution is the thing that sort of, like, everything afterwards is different now. And it's almost as if, sort of, like, in its happening, it's shown that things were never actually what they were, as well. It's like the quote from Zhou Enlai, the Chinese premier, that is to say what the results of the French Revolution were. It is apocryphal. He didn't actually say that, or it was like a translation confusion. But that is also true, though, isn't it? And I think that's true of all of, like, the great events, that there is that they show everything in a different light, including everything that happened before them becomes different. And again, and 9/11 as well, it is an example, like you've been saying, is an example of that, because it isn't just that it completely changes everything that came before or came after it. It is almost like everything before it becomes read through that lens, or is now interpretable by this new hermeneutic, which didn't exist before it existed, but now it exists. It's as if it has always existed. You know, obviously, and all of us at the moment are still living through the great, like, meta event of the coronavirus pandemic, which is, I think, we were all around for 9/11, and I'm assuming we all remember it to varying levels of vividness. But when it comes to, like, I think this is probably sort of like we're all adults for the coronavirus pandemic, obviously. So I think that, like, it's been a more visceral experience, a sort of, like, complete estrangement from what the world was meant to be like for us. Like, we all know that, like, however long it takes us to get up the other end of it, like, it's never the same as it was before. Like, you know, the before times are permanently and irrevocably lost, and indeed our accessing of it is kind of coloured by what our, you know, by the event that we're still in the midst of right now, that it just feels sort of, like, infinitely strange to imagine that, sort of, like, for most of our lives, like, we actually didn't worry about if going to the pub could kill our granny, you know.
But it's also,
I do want to do a, sorry,
see if we let Corey go.
Yeah, I was just gonna say, it's also similar to, like, climate change. Like, that as an event has been happening for, like, 100 years, but it's only now that we're actually starting to be able to experience it day to day. Like, when we do see these extreme weather events, and we do see, like, you know, like I was saying, that Melbourne weather, we just don't have summer yet, really. It's like these things, it's been an event in the background that is now, like, people haven't had to really understand it or even admit that it was there until now. So it's an, like, it's definitely going to be one of those, you know, another big event that we'd look back on, like 9/11 or the pandemic. But I feel like people aren't ready just yet to start doing that.
Yeah, I feel like that's kind of the key point. I was going to say at least one word of caution, just in case. I never know what level of fellow pedants kind of listen to our podcast. But I do know for one thing that, I mean, and I'm not even, I couldn't even comment on it really, but I do know that at least for Bourdieu, Alain Bourdieu is also, like, very famous for referencing, making use of the concept of the event, most famously in his book Being an Event. But I do know he quite forcefully disagrees with Deleuze's reading, and there's probably a whole other conversation in how they differ. Whether Bourdieu just thinks they differ and how they actually differ is probably another question. But there's a lot in there that was probably a whole other, could probably, well, people have written whole books on trying to untangle the two. So I will say that at least as a word of caution for anyone that's further interested in that. But I do think, at least for Deleuze, that I think that is that core point of, you know, yeah, how ready are we to are we ready to respond? Is it something even that we can respond to? I think this is part of that, the paradox of becoming, because I mean, it's the very last paragraph of that first chapter, where he talks a bit about uncertainty, or even, like, the uncertainty that I guess that Alice is going through. And what does he say? He says that, for personal uncertainty is not a doubt foreign to what is happening, but rather an objective structure of the event itself. insofar as it moves in two directions at once, and insofar as it fragments the subject following this double direction. Paradox is initially that which destroys good sense as the only direction, but it is then that which destroys common sense as the assignation of fixed identities. And I think what he kind of means by that, which I guess he also kind of picks up again in Pure Immanence, there's kind of such resonance between his different texts, but there's this line where he says, so he's talking about consciousness, or consciousness of an event, or the event. And he says, consciousness becomes a fact only when a subject is produced at the same time as its object. Which I think is a really interesting point about culture, and even especially the COVID pandemic. Because I think we're all very conscious of what's happened, and the future of our world, of our culture, is kind of uncertain. I think everyone has different ideas of how we'll have to adapt, how things will change, or even a stubbornness that nothing should change and we shouldn't change our fixed identity, our fixed sense of how the world is and should be, because of this virus. But I think I'd hope a lot of people, that something has to change. We have to change in response to the event that has happened. And I think it's only like, you know, there's as if there's a kind of COVIDian subject that is being produced, and we maybe don't know what that is yet. Because it's not really being produced at the same time as its object. The object is the coronavirus. But we haven't kind of yet gotten to a point where we can maybe understand what it is we are becoming, what the world is becoming, and there's kind of an active sense of resisting that. It kind of reminded me that I wanted to at least pull up on, at least how that relates to Alice, at least rather than jump, I was going to bounce jump around, but I don't want to jump around too much, I think how that relates to Alice anyway, that I think is really interesting, is that from that paragraph that you read out, Sean, where Edlos is basically describing things that happen to Alice. She becomes big, she becomes small, she's transformed, she goes through metamorphoses. And interestingly, from that story, which I actually read last year, for the first time, like read Lewis Carroll's book. I'm very familiar with the Disney adaptation. I'd never actually read the book. It's so good. I was like, it was one of my favorite reading experiences last year. Like, I'd never quite. It's one of those great things of discovering like a classic that's actually worthy of its reputation. really loved it. But anyway, but you know, Alice is going through these things. She's distraught at first. I guess there's the images that are kind of iconic from the cartoon version, right? Where I always think of like she grows and she kind of outgrows that house, and she's like trapped in this now what was made through either a doll's house or a normal sized house, and she's just become a giant and she's stuck and distressed. But when she, you know, yeah, she changes and she struggles to adapt. But it's as if that, you know, as time kind of goes on, she kind of the very being that she was comfortable in, Alice, starts to sort of dissolve. She kind of learns how to use each transformation to her advantage. Like, these things kind of happen to her by accident or through ignorance or naivety. She drinks a bottle or whatever else. It just says, like, eat me, right? Or someone will say, drink me.
Eat me, drink me, yeah.
She has no idea what's going to happen to her. She just does it, and then she has to deal with the consequences. But she does deal with them. And it's like, it's almost as if it's a pure becoming, because I think Deleuze says, like, the one thing that's repeated, rather all these different things happen, but the one thing that consistently happens to her is that there's the loss of the proper name is the adventure which is repeated throughout Alice's adventures, which is what Deleuze says. So it's soon enough, it's, you know, Alice is no longer defined by her name, by her shape, or by some sort of symbolic or material essence. It's kind of like a ship of Theseus problem, right? She's like, is she really Alice anymore? But I guess the thing is that she remains who she is and further becomes who she is over time. There's no such thing as big Alice, small Alice, normal Alice. Those kind of, through the process that she goes through, those qualities become utterly meaningless till there's no Alice quotation marks there at all. But who Alice is in the end her actions, how she responds to the things that happen to her, which I think is kind of a sort of fascinating way of looking at how we think about people. And again, I mean, I feel like it's very, it's my favorite thing about this concept, and also kind of maybe doesn't bode well for doing a coherent podcast episode, but like, I feel like a great example of that is in the when it becomes pure immanence alive. And Deleuze uses the example of the our mutual friend, the story from Charles Dickens. And I kind of want to read it just briefly, where it's the story of there's a scene in that book where there's a disreputable man, a rogue, held in contempt by everyone, who's found as he lies dying. Suddenly those taking care of him manifest an eagerness, respect, even love for his slightest sign of life. Everyone bustles about to save him, to the point where in his deepest coma this wicked man himself senses something soft and sweet penetrating him. But to the degree that he comes back to life, his saviours turn colder, and he becomes once again mean and crude. Between his life and his death, there is a moment that is only that of a life playing with death. The life of the individual gives way to an impersonal and yet singular life that releases a pure event freed from the accidents of internal and external life, that is, from the subjectivity and objectivity of what happens. Which is quite an extreme example, I think, to talk about how someone is responded to, someone who nobody likes is responded to in the moment of their death. But I think that sense of the life of the individual gives way to an impersonal and yet singular life that releases a pure event freed from the accidents of internal and external life also describes Alice in Wonderland. And it's kind of the very surreality of that that I find, it's actually kind of what I love both about Logic of Sense and about Pure Immanence, where these things sound wholly bizarre, but as Deleuze starts to talk about them, you kind of see how this very surreal sort of psychedelic view of existence is also kind of there with us in the very mundane things of facts of our lives, the kind of our material existences in just the way that we live and die or change into cats and playing cards and other things.
Actually, at that same conference I mentioned earlier, New Trinitarian Ontologies, which you can, if you have many hours of your life spare, you can watch all of it on YouTube. I think you might even be able to see the back of my head somewhere. But I remember at the very last panel, John Milbank, who is one of my favorite Twitter follows because of just the absolute, just the, how he leaps between some of the most interesting tweets you'll find about sort of like the nature of God and religion to just being apoplectic with rage that tattoos are a thing. I just remember at the very last panel, though, there was a question which was something like, "What is the future? You know, what is the future of theology?" And one thing he said was he thinks, you know, it was something like, "We need to draw attention back to the paradoxes, which just like inarguably actually exist in our lives all of the time, and in the universe, in reality, as a way of rediscovering the fact that the universe, the fact that existence, creation, is just fundamentally mysterious." And the example he gave was the problem of universals, of relationality, which is, again, one of the great perennial problems of philosophy, for which there are a million answers, but none of them really satisfy. And all that we've been saying so far about becoming, about the event, just reminds me of that again. Sort of like just this, and I think it's really important. So I think the stuff about the Zeno's arrow, I think, is actually maybe an important way of reading this. Again, just this discovery of these fundamental, perennial, foundational problems of not only philosophical thought, but just of actually just like being aware of the world, the fact that, and of its, the way that it does just seem to move out of our grasp, how it does always seem to be flowing out of our fingers when we try to just define even the most simple qualities of existence, like when, like what is the process of becoming? yeah, how can we talk about it in terms of starting and ending, really talk about it in terms of starting and ending. I think this might be an opportunity, because you've already started talking about imminence of life, Matt. Like I said, this is, I have notes prepared for this bit. So I do want to turn our attention to this a little bit more. And I think this is, and you know, what's really striking here is obviously in the title is that it isn't life, it is a life that Deleuze is talking about and is kind of presenting as the event par excellence, right? The that there is nothing more like an event than simply a life. And obviously the indefinite article there, like it makes it so, it's genius because it simultaneously makes it very, very broad and general what he's talking about. A life can be any life, but also it also implies a particularity and a, you know, a specificness to it, that because the thing is that, you know, there is never such a thing as life as such. There are only ever lives. There is only ever a life that we are talking about. My life, your life, our lives. They always have this kind of singularity to them. And what you're saying, like, in the passage about Dickens writing about the criminal on the verge of death, and how as he is coming closer and closer to death, the fatness of, like, the lifeness of his life, that it is a life, becomes more and more readily apparent as these as the fact that he has a life becomes more specifically his own life, even as the specificities of his life give way as he comes closer and closer to his death, if that makes any sense at all. And I think it's important to what you were saying as well there about the nature of the name and the loss of the proper name as well is very interesting here, because there's that remark in I forget where it is, Deleuze says it, I think it might be in The Superiority of Anglo-American Literature, but I might be mistaken, where he says that we have names only in the same way that military campaigns have names. Yeah, that's that name that we have never really actually refers to an individual, but it is, but it broadly designates several processes that run in parallel, you know, which can be quite a disturbing way of thinking about ourselves and our lives in some ways, because it robs us of a sense of the concrete. But what we gain instead is a sense of the just the absolute, is the kind of the absolute freedom that we have. You know, because this is in many ways like, you know, what Deleuze's objectives as a philosopher are quite simple. That he wants us to be happy. You know, he wants joy to flourish more abundantly. He wants us to have life and to have it in abundance. And often there is this when you get like. And that's why I quite like these sort of like more off-the-cuff texts, you know, these shorter kind of punchy ones, where you get more of a sense of what he's really about, is that he has this kind of like Nietzschean drive to sort of like the intrepid and the joyous going on there, the daring, as opposed to striation and organism, you know. Yes, here's a quote here, and I think this actually is... No, this isn't what... No, you didn't read this one, Matt. I was just making sure we wasn't repeating you. It is a heiacity no longer of individuation, but of singularization. A life of pure immanence, neutral, beyond good and evil. For it was only the subject that incarnated it in the midst of things that made it good or bad. The life of individuality fades away in favour of the singular life immanent to a man who no longer has a name, though he can be mistaken for no other. A singular essence, a life. And I actually found it almost an emotional experience reading this text, because this is the this was the last thing Deleuze wrote before his suicide. So there is this, and in the introduction to the edition I have, like I said, it is sometimes viewed almost as like a testament that he produced here. And I think in so many ways it feels like he is kind of like bringing it all together, what he was really, really about, into a single work here. And I'm actually going to read out, this is the closing passage from the introduction, which is by John Reichman, I think his name is pronounced. Written in the strange interval before his own death, Immanence Alive has been regarded as a kind of testament. What is clear is that Deleuze took its last message to occur at a time of renewed difficulty and possibility for philosophy. Over Besson, one needed to again introduce movement into thought rather than trying to find universals of information or communication, in particular into the very image of the brain and contemporary neuroscience. In the place of artificial intelligence, one needed to construct a new picture of the brain as a relatively undifferentiated matter into which thinking and art might introduce new connections that didn't pre-exist them. As it were, the brain as materiality of a life yet to be invented, prior and irreducible to consciousness, as well as machines. In his last writing, Immanence Alive, we sense not only this new problem, this new urgency, but also the force of the long, incredible voyage in which Deleuze kept alive the singular image of thought which has the naivete and strength to believe that philosophy brings about a vast deviation of wisdom. It puts it in the service of a pure immanence. And in many ways, you know, the question of what is immanence has been, I think, really like the spectre that haunts this whole podcast. Like, that's actually like the one we've never really confronted. Like, we've talked around it, we talked about the plane of immanence, but when it comes to actually what is immanence, is like, that is almost like the great unanswerable question of Deleuzian philosophy. I think, you know, I read that Derrida gave the eulogy at Deleuze's funeral, and he says something like, sort of like, Deleuze's like philosophy is trying to deal with this mystery that he called immanence. I don't know. I don't know what immanence is, but I know that if immanence is like anything, it's like a life, which is something which is both particular and also kind of full of a strange kind of, I don't want to say universalness, because Deleuze isn't about universals, you know. Actually, did you want to go there, Corey? Because I've been rabbiting on.
I was just going to say that the first time I read that chapter from Immanence Alive, I think I kind of tapped into some of the stuff that you're talking about, but when I went back to reread, I don't know what sparked the thought, but I was almost thinking of immanence as being like the way that you can, on very rare occasions, be in the moment of your life. Like, you are actually living, but then transcendence is anything that brings you out of that imminent moment. And I just kind of felt that in Immanence Alive, that there was kind of like a kind of a tension between immanence and transcendence, with immanence being the thing that Deleuze wanted to draw you towards. And like, so I was thinking of it in terms of depression, the way that like depression robs you of being able to just be in that moment, because like, you know, you're too, like, everything is shit, you can't think yourself through the muck, all that kind of stuff, and so you're just stuck in all this bullshit instead of just being and being in joy. And I just kind of, and I didn't actually, like, this is how terrible a scholar I am, I didn't realize that Deleuze committed suicide. So I was definitely picking up on some like depressive themes in this chapter. And what you said about Deleuze wanting us to live, like, his whole philosophy was like, you know, telling us to live, you know, more like joyous lives, or however it was that you worded it, like, that really speaks to me as someone with who struggles with depression. I think it's interesting that I was picking up on that without actually realizing the connections to his real life.
Yeah,
I mean, it's interesting because it's a fact that Deleuze committed suicide, but I think that there's almost a strange reason why it's not really acknowledged. Is, I think maybe it doesn't seem to be because he was depressed. It was like, it was part of, I think it's because he had lung problems for a long, long time.
I think because he'd had a lung removed, hadn't he?
Yeah, he'd had it was like a thoraplexy or something. I think it's interesting because I remember there was loads of, there's a great, it's kind of where Badiou kind of comes back in. Badiou has this lifelong animosity towards Deleuze, and apparently it's because during May 68, Badiou was kind of a militant student. Deleuze was kind of perceived as this kind of bourgeois professor, and he wasn't really present for any of the protests. The reason why, he was recovering from the surgery of having his lung removed, and otherwise he's very much right on with the protests, but these things get in the way. But yeah, he had this horrible, he was really, really unwell. And I almost feel like the reason why people don't necessarily beyond the technicality, don't see it as a suicide, it's almost, it was like it was euthanasia. His way of going out on his own terms. Yeah, like a kind of... it's not really euthanasia, but I think it's... Whilst he still had the potential to go out on his terms, he did. So it's kind of... It's not a negation of his life. It's an affirmation of his circumstances. Whether that you can call that a joyous or a thing, probably not, but it's at least an affirmation. But I do, I think that point that you made too about being in the moment is totally right. Like there's the, I think it's one of my, it's my favorite line from this, The Pure Immanence, where it's this kind of thread that's actually in a lot of Deleuze's stuff. He has this, I think he talks about it in Proust and Signs. He kind of draws on this idea of narcissism from Freud, the narcissism of children and animals who have no interest in people outside of themselves. An animal just goes about its business. It doesn't necessarily, unless you've domesticated it to expect food from you. Well, cats are probably the great example. We kind of love them for how disinterested in this we are. We find that enchanting. Same with children. You can watch a child play totally involved in itself, and it's a joy to watch. I think that's what he means when he sort of talks about in Pure Immanence. He says, small children, through all their sufferings and weaknesses, are infused with an immanent life that is pure power and even bliss. And there's a sense of, this is in The Fold actually, but there's a similar thing where in The Fold, in talking about the event, Deleuze talks about this sense of satisfaction is a self-enjoyment, which marks the way by which the subject is filled with itself and attains a richer and richer private life. And then jumping back to, I don't know if actually this is The Fold or The Pure Immanence now, I'm kind of getting tied up, but as a way to demonstrate that kind of beyond any sort of self-involved, all too human sense of narcissism, he kind of draws back on like the Spinozism of, I think what Spinoza talks about when nature is naturing. And Deleuze describes the plant that sings of the glory of God. And while being filled all the more with itself, it contemplates and intensely contracts the elements which it precedes. It feels in this prehension the self-enjoyment of its own becoming. As if to say, I kind of just love that idea of a plant kind of just being blissful in its just doing what it does, just growing what, I've forgotten the word for plant things now, like a bud becoming a tree, you know, that whole literally, like, I don't know, thinking of that as like a filling with yourself. I kind of really love that imagery. But nature's kind of the perfect, it's kind of Deleuze's Spinozism coming through. It's the perfect sort of example that makes more sense to talk about nature doing it than just for us almost, which I kind of actually, I think it's probably quite significant.
Yeah, reminds me a little Vedantic expression that's Sat Chit Ananda, which means being, consciousness, bliss, as an ideal state. I want to go into, I'm conscious of time, so I don't think we'll be spending too much longer on this, but there's a couple of things I did want to bring out still, and I want to go into the weeds a little bit about some of the stuff that Deleuze says here. I'm just going to read what I've written in my notes, actually. Deleuze confronts Heidegger, though, without naming him. He says in Immanence of Life, but we shouldn't enclose life in the single moment when individual life confronts universal death. And what's happening here, but why I say he's confronting Heidegger here is because Heidegger, in Being and Time, he posits death being towards death as being essentially kind of like the, I'm simplifying, but that's kind of like the concrete upon which Dasein is built, really, because that's, you know, the most certain of all of the possibilities that there is the fact, is our finitude of our non-existence. And Deleuze seems to be denying that, because he says, I've written here, instead Deleuze locates a life in between times, between moments. And this goes back to what we were saying about events and becoming from Logic of Sense, where the event, the becoming, happens it's a pushing and a pulling. It's a happening in the in between. It's the in betweenness itself. What Deleuze is saying here is that a life is becoming, is and becoming is always indefinite and indeterminate, and has a kind of infinity to it almost. That it does not have a start or an end, and seems to almost locate, it occupy all of the, I mean, no, he says that sort of Alice isn't both large and small at the same time, but it does almost feel like you're trying to encompass an event or happening in your mind. You end up with this paradox of something that is multiple things at once, and there's all of its possibilities at once. And there is something just really, really moving about the thinking about a life in those terms, that it's something that doesn't really start or end. In the same way that when you put an iron ball in the fire and it starts getting hotter, there's never a stopping point, you know, in the becoming hotter of it. That there is this, and if that is true of our lives as well, then there is neither kind of like an end to it nor a start to it, because to have a life is to be a becoming, is to simply be becoming. And becoming never really reaches an end in the same way that becoming never really starts. That we ourselves are, that we ourselves are the paradox of being.
Yeah, I feel like there's, I think what I really like about that too is it kind of comes back to the sort of awful circumstances of his death in a way. Like, that becoming never ends, or is never. It's also not interrupted by things that go wrong. Like, it's not interrupted by illness or by wounding or by whatever. Those are the things that happen to you. And I think it kind of maybe is telling that it's kind of the one thing that I want to bring up that I think is a name that Deleuze sort of sprinkles about all these texts, but it's a poet, a French poet called Joe Busquet, who was blown up by a hand grenade in the First World War, was paralysed. I think he had a spinal cord injury. But then just, he was expected to die as a sort of injury, at least at that time, that you wouldn't be expected to live for very long. He kind of defied all expectation and lived for years and just stayed in bed for the rest of his life, but surrounded himself by books and paintings and friends and produced this enormous wealth of poetry and novels and plays. And it's from Deleuze, it's from him rather, that Deleuze gets this line that I think he quotes in multiple places, which is, where is it? My wound existed before me. So there's this great bit in actually one of the seminars, I think it's the seminar that was to become the fold, called Leibniz and the Event, that Deleuze gave when he was teaching. And he sort of says that one of the great moralists of the event is the poet Joe Busquet. Busquet suffered a ghastly wound that paralyzed him, and among other things, everything that he tried to say and explain was in some manner this event. I was created to incarnate it. That is, starting from this, his problem was in a certain manner being worthy of the event. And there's just an extra line that he says that I think he kind of, there's a sense that in Deleuze's talking, he seems to speak very differently than he writes. He has a sense that he's losing people, which you don't get as a reader when he loses you, but he kind of then wanders around, but he just, there's this extra line, he sort of waffles a bit and he says, you know, what makes those who whine so difficult to be around? They're not worthy of what happens to them. I think that's a really interesting way that there is this kind of real affirmation that, yeah, becoming never ends, and it's not interrupted by something that goes wrong in your life. Whether that's you become paralyzed, whether you're like Deleuze and you have your lungs removed, whether you're Nietzsche and you're kind of I think that's the thing that I find in Nietzsche and Bataille's work really interesting. Like, both Nietzsche and Bataille have this shared, the affinity between them, both that Bataille recognizes, is that both, I think they're both, their fathers went mad, went senile, got dementia or schizophrenia, or had some sort of, at that time, not very well diagnosed mental illness. And then as children, they witnessed it and had, you know, it kind of was informed their lives. And then for Nietzsche, the sort of fear is that, well, that it was kind of hereditary, and it seemed that it was. He was, his life started with this experience of the madness of his father, and then he kind of comes into his own becoming mad. but still writes through it, still makes himself worthy of that process. The becoming never ends, just because that sense of, I guess that's kind of why A Life, I think, is also quite such a inspiring and sort of life-affirming, paradoxically life-affirming concept, because it sort of shows that even if your life no longer resembles the values and mores of your given age, you're not living according to, you know, you're not living the good life. You're still living a life, and being able to make the best of that under your own circumstances, under your own will to power, is enough, and counts for a lot. I think it's actually quite rare that you get something that forceful and kind of ethical from what sort of begins as a really knotted philosophy of time.
I think I'm going to suggest that we bring things to a close now, because we've been talking for at least an hour now. But I do just want to read just the last passage from Immanence Life, actually. Because I think it's, it's not necessarily going to illuminate everything that we said before us. It's going to introduce some confusion, but I think it's also just, it puts things just very, very, in a very lovely way. But I just want to share. A life contains only virtuals. It is made up of virtualities, events, singularities. What we call virtue is not something that lacks reality, but something that is engaged in a process of actualization following the plane that gives it its particular reality. The imminent event is actualized in a state of things and of the lived that make it happen. The plane of immanence is itself actualized in an object and a subject to which it attributes itself. But however inseparable an object and a subject may be from their actualization, the plane of immanence is itself virtual, so long as the events that populate it are virtualities. Events or singularities give to the plane all their virtuality, just as the plane of immanence gives virtual events their full reality. The event considered as non-actualized indefinite is lacking in nothing. It suffices to put it in relation to its concomitants, a transcendental field, a plane of immanence, a life, singularities. A wound is incarnated or actualized in a state of things or of life. But it is itself a pure virtuality on the plane of immanence that leads us into a life. My wound existed before me. Not a transcendence of the wound as higher actuality, but its immanence as a virtuality always within a milieu, plane or field. There is a big difference between the virtuals that define the immanence of the transcendental field and the possible forms that actualize them and transform them into something transcendent. Well, I just think that's quite lovely how he puts it there. I'm going to open the floor to last comments, and then we will call it a night.
I think it's interesting that on our last episode focused on Deleuze, we ended on the man's death and, you know, his thoughts on life. I think we've done a good job of bringing it full circle without even really meaning to.
Yeah, I thought the same thing. And also, strangely, like, I think a lot of what's discussed here, this kind of making yourself worthy of what happens to you, this understanding of the things maybe being outside of your control, what you can do about it, what we should all do about it, this kind of political sense of strange time and how the past and the future act upon us and all this stuff. It all feels very, very complex when coming at it through Deleuze, but I think it also sets us up really nicely for talking about Mark Fisher next year. I think it's a thread that at least I recognise. It's kind of it's my favourite thing about Deleuze, and I think it's my favourite thing about Mark Fisher. So there's a really nice, it's a coming full circle. It's kind of appropriate, right? It feels like there's an ending, but nonetheless, we go on.
Yeah.
Yes. So, well then, thank you for being with us over the last 12 months. It is 12 months that we've been doing this podcast. We hope that you have enjoyed it. We hope you've gotten stuff from it. And I hope that you'll choose to continue along with us as we move into what will hopefully be the slightly less rarefied territory of Mark Fisher. I think there's going to be a lot more chats about films and novels and music in particular. I think it's going to be really, really fun. It's going to be really, really, I think it's going to be really, really exciting. So, like, next phase in what we're doing.
Yeah.
And like I said, hopefully we'll be delivering stuff a little bit more quickly than we have been. Okay, then. So, Corey, where can people find you?
Find me on Twitter at CJ White.
Do you have anything coming out in the near or immediate future?
Not really. I've got stories in some anthologies over the next couple of years, but those haven't been officially announced yet. So we'll keep it on the down low.
Matt, do you want? Where can people find you?
You can find me at Xenogothic in most places. I think Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and xenogothic.com for everything else.
Yes, and you can find me at Hauntonaut on Twitter. And yes, I suppose last week to say is actually kind of Merry Christmas. You know, we're recording this, 11 days from Christmas. Yes, everybody have a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year, I guess. Please keep on, please stay safe. Please look after yourselves while trying to have a little bit of fun at the same time. And looking forward to seeing all of you next year. And yeah, I suppose that's it from us. That's our last episode of the year. So again, just thank you for joining us over the last 12 months and we'll be seeing you next year. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye. We'll be right back.